This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We start today in Natick, where it took more than a year and a half to bring charges against an officer who is accused of indecent assault on a police dispatcher. Along the way, complaints of police dragging their feet on the investigation and refusing to turn over records. WBUR's Ali Jarmanning has been reporting the story with Deputy Managing Editor Todd Wallach. Joins us now from the newsroom. Welcome back, Ali.
Thanks for having me.
So lay out the basics for us.
Yeah, so this is kind of a long story, so bear with me here. So this all starts in April 2020. A handful of cops and a police dispatcher get together to have after a night shift on an Easter morning to have some drinks. So it's a couple of officers, James Quilty and this dispatcher. And the dispatcher says that Quilty stuck his hand down her pants, and then after the other cops leave, traps her kind of in her car, and puts her hand on his crotch over his pants, gropes her again. The dispatcher is eventually able to leave, tells her mother, tells a colleague, another dispatcher, and the word floats up to a police lieutenant, Kara Rossi, and you would think that the police lieutenant would start investigating, but what prosecutors say is that nothing happened at that point. It kind of got blown off. Months later, Quilty is up for a promotion to police sergeant, and the chief gets wind of what happens and orders Rossi, the lieutenant, to do a full investigation. Well, that full investigation was asking the police dispatcher in front of Quilty at work, hey, do you have anything to report? The dispatcher says no, and Rossi drops it again.
So meaning not a full investigation.
No, definitely. And so it really seems like the town treats it at that point like a sexual harassment charge. The chief ends up, or somehow the town administrator finds out about it. He orders a law firm to do, or he hires a law firm to do an investigation. And the investigation comes back, and they end up signing a last chance agreement with Quilty, allowing him to stay on the force. And so by June 2021, he's back on the force. He's served a suspension, and it seems like everything is all wrapped up at that point. But it was not. So we at WBUR that summer got wind of the allegations. A blogger, an independent blogger, did as well and started asking for records. So this is last summer, summer of 21. And the town looks like they start investigating again. And by the winter, December 2021, Quilty is indicted on 3 counts of indecent assault and battery for the assault on the dispatcher. So that brings us to where we are now.
Okay, so 2 things. First, for listeners, we may again be covering some of the details of the charges here, and they may be troubling for some listeners, mm-hmm. So heads up on that. So we get to criminal charges, Ali. Is there anything else other than sort of new light being shown on it that gets us to that point? Do we know?
That's what's really unclear is why it took so long to get to criminal charges in the first place, why the town put him back to work before any kind of criminal charges had been filed, and what the town did or didn't do. The big thing with this story is the town has refused to provide any records about what happened. They have said very little to us or anybody else when they've asked about what happened here. And so it's difficult to know, how did the town handle this? Did they follow policy? And what really happened in this whole situation?
Speaking with WBUR's Ali Jarmanning from the newsroom today, Quilty has pleaded not guilty. What does he have to say about the charges?
Yeah, so his attorney says, you know, this was a misunderstanding, that Quilty thought he had the dispatcher's consent. And, you know, he apologized on behalf of Quilty when he was in court and said, you know, he feels very badly for what happened, but he basically misread the room. And prosecutors say, you know, there was no way this was a misunderstanding. The dispatcher said repeatedly she wanted to leave. She didn't want that to happen. And so this was an assault of act, they say.
So let's talk about town officials specifically, because there's the police department, but then there's the town. It's almost like concentric circles,
yeah.
Right? So have you spoken with any town officials?
Yeah. So, well, I've reached out to many town officials. And so the town administrator would not speak to me. The police chief would not speak to me. I did eventually get on the phone the chair of the select board, a man named Paul Joseph. And he said, you know, the town doesn't want to say anything right now while the criminal case proceeds. And so we have a little bit of tape from what he told me.
We do, as a board, have confidence in the process we're undertaking. And we are trying to do it in the spirit of transparency and fairness to the parties that are involved.
And, you know, it's not really clear what that's going to look like or when we're going to start seeing some of that transparency from the town.
And reading the story following your reporting on this, that is really a striking piece, was how hard it was to get information, to get records.
Yeah. So my editor, Todd, you know, started last summer putting in records requests for the town's investigation. That law firm that was hired to do an investigation of Quilty asked for the discrimination complaint that was filed by the dispatcher after this incident happened.
To the state. Right?
Yeah, exactly. To the Mass Commission Against Discrimination. And, you know, they refused to provide any of that. WBUR has filed a public records lawsuit to be able to get some of those records because we believe that they are public and we're waiting for a response from the town.
Okay. All right. So just stand by, Allie. I'm going to bring in another voice here because during your reporting, you spoke with Mark Wynn. And Wynn is a retired lieutenant with the Nashville Police Department who has investigated and trains police on how to respond to domestic and sexual violence within their departments. Mark's on the line. Mark, welcome.
Good morning. How are you?
Great to have you, Mark. Thanks. First, just your reactions to what Allie and I have just been discussing.
Well, you know, domestic violence and sex assault committed by law enforcement, you know, should not and cannot be tolerated by police leaders across the country. It's really an abuse of power and authority, and it defrauds the public of their civil rights and dishonors the oath of a noble profession. So it can't be tolerated. And how you communicate about that is important as a police leader inside your agency and outside the agency. And, you know, I tell communities all the time when I'm talking about this issue, it's up to you as a community to decide how much sexual violence and domestic violence you want your officers to commit.
So that is a jarring way to put it, Mark Wynn. Do we see that there is a pattern of silence, inavailability of records, failure to pursue allegations, et cetera? I mean, if you do training on this, I'm assuming it's because there's need for that in departments across the country.
There is. I do quite a bit of training for the International Association of Chiefs of Police and the State Department and the U.S. Justice Department. And we are just now coming into our own around dealing with domestic violence. Sexual misconduct by police is one of the issues that we haven't spent a lot of time on, but it is a major problem across the country. And, you know, and the more controversial and sensitive an issue is, the stronger the city's leadership or the community's leadership has to be. I mean, you have to make sure that you're screening people correctly, that you're training people correctly, that there's no misunderstanding about how you feel as a city leader or law enforcement leader about these kind of issues. You know, we've been struggling to try to get women in policing for years. And this is one of the things when you talk to young women about this, why you don't go into policing. This is it, a male-dominated profession where you've got these issues that come up. You know, the Canadians, they're at 30%. The Australians are at 30% female in law enforcement. We're still at 10 in this country.
So, Mark, what do you specifically train departments and towns that they need to do differently?
Well, you've got to have a policy on this, and you've got to have transparency, and you've got to have, you know, careful, you know, investigations, and they have to be confidential, obviously, but that doesn't mean you as a leader can't stand in front of a camera or a microphone and tell the community how you feel about these crimes most often committed against women. And there's nothing, you know, you're not violating confidentiality. You're just showing leadership. You're modeling for the people who work for you, and you're telling the people who pay you how you feel about these kind of incidents. You know, sex assault is a major problem to begin with. I mean, the CDC's told us, you know, 1 in 5 women will experience a completed or attempted rape in their lifetime. That's 32 million U.S. women. So this is a major problem that we have a responsibility to deal with, especially if it's in the ranks of law enforcement.
We're talking about a case in Natick this week, police misconduct and failure, or slow-moving reaction to it. We've been speaking with Allie Jarmaning, who's a senior WBUR reporter here, reporting on the story. Right now, we've got Mark Wynn, who's a retired lieutenant with the Nashville Police Department, who trains departments on this. Mark, is there anything in this particular case, this Natick case, that is particularly striking or unusual to you, given your work?
Well, I mean, it wouldn't be fair for me to analyze the case investigation until I've seen the entire case and prosecution. But interviewing victims and offenders, possible offenders in the same room together, it's something that's just not done. It used to be back in the 60s and 70s, when I first started policing in 77, if that is what happened, if they confronted an alleged abuser in front of the victim, it's like interviewing a bank clerk and a bank robber in the same case and telling the bank robber where the bank clerk lives. It's just not proper if that is what happened. So, immediate response is what is critical. Early intervention is critical. And what part the supervisors play. And then their message to you as the media. I mean, they should be in front of the media telling you, look, we can't discuss this individual case, but here's our position on this. This is how we feel about it. This is our priority. So they'll send a message to the rank and file that it's not going to be tolerated.
So, Mark, that is my last question to you, is striking that balance between preserving or protecting identity, privacy of people involved as an investigation is ongoing, especially of the alleged victim, but also providing the level of transparency that builds trust, ensures daylight, et cetera. What do you advise cities and towns about how to strike that balance?
Well, how do you communicate to the public? I mean, obviously through the media, through your website, through your Facebook page, there's got to be an ongoing commitment for you to tell the public exactly what you're doing. And then when you're finished with it, tell them what the results were. Did you clear the officer? Did you arrest the officer? You know, did you fire the officer? You know, the police work for the public. The public doesn't work for the police. So there needs to be a clear, transparent message that we will not tolerate this kind of behavior because so much is at stake. You know, around 16 or 17% of rape victims report to law enforcement. That's today. We've got a real problem here in getting people to report. If you are transparent, then what will happen often, people will trust you and they'll report more.
All right, that's Mark Wynn, a retired lieutenant with the Nashville Police Department who has investigated and trained police on how to respond to domestic and sexual violence within their own departments. Mark, I appreciate you calling in and joining us today. Thanks.
No, thank you. It's a very important topic. I'm glad you're covering it.
Thanks, Mark. So I'm turning back here to WBUR senior reporter Allie Jarmanning, who's still with us in studio. Allie, what really struck me about Mark was the larger implications of both women on the force and reporting outside of police departments as well. Your reactions to what we just heard.
Yeah, I thought he makes a really good point about police. There's already so little trust, especially among sexual assault victims and survivors, with the authorities, with police, with the criminal justice system. And seeing the reaction like this and seeing what we reported, I think if I was a victim, I would feel even less comfortable going to the police and wanting to talk to them. And I think one of the things that Mark said, too, that really stuck out to me is how do you communicate this with your own officers about how we are going to tolerate this or not? And so that was one of the really striking things in this case. Was kind of how the town, what the prosecutors laid out about how the town responded and how particularly Lieutenant Kara Rossi responded and how she, you know, kind of brushed this off at the beginning. And then, as Mark reiterated, asked the victim, do you have anything to report right now?
So I should point out, Allie, you in your reporting, you note that Rossi has gone on to become a head of police in another town. Have you had comments or contact from Rossi?
I reached out to the town administrator that hired Rossi and did not hear anything back. And I reached out to Rossi herself to try to talk to her and get her explanation about that and did not get anything. We did speak to the town and were able to confirm that they were not able to get access to the discrimination complaint that was filed by the dispatcher against Natick and Rossi. So they didn't have that information when they were hiring her this spring, which is really troubling, too.
So, Allie, you've done a ton of reporting on criminal justice, police officers, police departments. What really sort of took you aback or stood out to you about this particular story?
Yeah, I mean, we've done a lot of reporting looking at we've been looking at police officers accused of domestic and sexual violence and found in some of our reporting that more than 40 departments will not provide even sometimes the names of officers accused of these kinds of crimes. And so this was an opportunity where we dug into one of those cases and just saw about how insidious it can be and what the impacts can be in that kind of situation. And it can really affect the trust in the police department. Like Mark said, it affects people who live there. It affects people who might report crimes there. And I just think about the other police officers who are working there, too, and what they are learning or what becomes, normalized in the department.
So what's the thread you follow now? What comes next?
Well, for the Natick police, or for this situation, Quilty is trying to get the charges dismissed against him. He's trying to get the indictments thrown out. So he actually has a hearing this week on that. So I'm going to kind of see what happens with the criminal case.
And just to remind listeners, this is the police officer who's accused of indecent assault against a police dispatcher in Natick.
Right. He's pled not guilty. And, you know, I'm interested to see how the town responds to our public records suit that we filed. You know, very lucky to work at a place like BUR that is investing in these kind of lawsuits to be able to try to crack open some of the secrets. And, you know, more broadly, I'm doing reporting on, and BUR in general is doing reporting on how police officer or how police departments respond when officers are accused of something like this. So I've been talking to a lot of people who were, you know, married to police officers or were police officers themselves about, hey, what did you see when an officer was accused of domestic or sexual violence? How did your department respond?
All right, WBUR senior reporter Allie Germanning, I hope you will come back and tell us more about that reporting as you do it.
I will.
Great to have you. Thanks.
Thank you.
Imagine there's a place in our world where the known things go. Corridors lined with lockers, filled with textbooks and backpacks and snacks. That place, this place, is a high school.
And that's Jill Lepore, Harvard professor, staff writer for The New Yorker, and host of The Last Archive, a podcast that asks, how do we know what we know? And how can we be sure? The first episodes of season three are just out, and Lepore brings her questions to a seemingly unlikely place, Cambridge Rinjan Latin School. Jill Lepore is with us now. Jill, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
So I did not see a high school coming in this, Jill.
Oh, but teenagers know everything.
Well, they were are quite impressive in this. And let's kind of lay out how we got to the point where you find yourself early on in this season in high school. So your first two seasons of this podcast focus on problems like conspiracy theories, propaganda, culture wars. And now you've moved into the solution space. And there was a piece of me wondering, was it because you just couldn't stand to be with the problems anymore? Or do you think we're in a solutions moment now?
Well, in this case, I was really inspired by my colleague at Harvard Law School, Jonathan Zittrain, had this great idea for a solution that was kind of a thought experiment. And I thought, oh, well, we could try to implement it and see what happens. So, I think there are some great ideas out there, but it's not always easy to try them out. This was a really fun opportunity to do that.
So Zittrain is co-founder and director of the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society. And here's a little bit of sound of him from your podcast spelling out the idea.
If we ask those students to have a look at the ads as they are proposed to be run on a platform like Facebook and take a moment and see if they pass some threshold of disinformation, and then see if they can come to consensus or, if necessary, a vote on whether the ad meets a minimum standard of truthfulness.
So this was really interesting, Jill, because you then go play out this experiment, and the first place you go is Cambridge Rinjan Latin. But it's an idea that he almost sort of tosses out playfully at first and gets more serious about it as he goes. That's one part crowdsourcing and one part civics education for high schoolers and one part juries, but with real practical application for how we decide what is sort of acceptable content if we don't want to leave it up to private media companies. Do I basically have that right?
Yeah. So, I mean, Zittrain said, you know, what is an institution that determines truth or falsehood that we still trust? And, you know, there's a lot of institutions people don't trust anymore, but people do trust the trial by jury system and, you know, abide by the verdict. Even people question elections, they question the media, but trial by jury is something people still believe in, research shows. So Zittrain said, so it's actually also a beautiful institution that high school kids, you know, should be studying. They should be preparing for thinking about their own jury service. And what about using their civics education as an opportunity to solve a problem that social media companies have, which is trying to decide whether or not to take down a political ad that's fishy? You know, social media companies don't like to be in this position. Facebook started, its Supreme Court, you know, YouTube has certain rules. Twitter just doesn't run political ads, or at least it hasn't yet.
And I should note, Facebook did in 2020 and is again here in 2022 banning political ads for the week leading up to Election Day. So this is a problem. And it sounds like we're at a point where pretty much everybody recognizes this is a problem. How can you be sure these ads are true? Should anybody adjudicate the truthiness of them and decide whether or not they should run? So you go to Cambridge Ringen Lantin. Tell us about how you get there.
So I know a really fantastic, you know, public schools have just such fantastic teachers, really dedicated public servants. And there's an amazing history teacher at Cambridge Ringen Lantin, Benji Cohen. And I've known him for a few years now. And I asked him, can we come do this in your class? And he said, oh, yeah. So we put together a lesson plan. And, you know, we went in for a day and went to a few different of his classes. And the students were completely game. And I was really totally unprepared for what would happen. I mean, I thought it was kind of interesting that Zittrain said this should work in the sense that Facebook or Twitter, these decisions should be binding on social media companies. And I thought, wow, that's a leap of faith to ask teenagers to make binding decisions that would determine whether political candidates' ads could be online. But after this day in Benji Cohen's classroom with these amazing high school students, I thought, yeah.
So we're speaking with Jill Lepore, Harvard professor, author, host of the podcast The Last Archive, which is just starting to release season 3. And we're talking about this pursuit of how to decide and if we should decide and who should decide whether political ads make it onto social media. So Jill, we've got some sound for the two ads that you presented to the students at Cambridge Ringen Lantin. So we're going to start with, these are both from the 2020 primary season in Wisconsin, and we're going to start with incumbent Senator Ron Johnson.
Democrat policies have been disastrous for America. Open borders and a flood of illegal immigrants. The 2020 summer riots, defunding the police, lowering bail and not prosecuting criminals, Kenosha set on fire.
And Democrat Mandela Barnes, current lieutenant governor who won the Democratic primary and is now facing Johnson in the general.
In this state, our state, we were the first to ratify the 19th Amendment, giving women the right to vote. We were the first to protect the rights of the LGBTQ community. We are game changers.
So, Jill, the first step that the high school students at Cambridge Ringen Lantin had to do was sort of figure out what even do I fact check in these two ads. And as I was running the mental exercise while I'm listening to your podcast, I'm thinking, wow, I'm not sure I even know where to start. Did you have a list in mind and were you sort of wondering, were you going to need to give it to them or did they just jump right in and take care of it?
Well, their teacher, Benji Cohen, had the idea that he should do this exercise with them first, ask them, what is a fact? And they had a great discussion about that. Then we watched the ads. We had picked two that we just thought they'd be unfamiliar with, so they'd be on kind of equal terrain about. They wouldn't have views on either of these candidates. This was back in February when Johnson and Barnes looked like that would be an interesting race, but we're kind of betting on that it might still be an interesting race, which turns out to have been.
Turns out you were right.
Yeah, and then we gave the kids transcripts so that they could look at the words in front of them, line by line with numbered lines. So yeah, so we watched ads a few times, and then they just kind of huddled together in groups and sort of, you know, if the way a magazine fact checker would sort of circled the assertions of fact, the statements that made claims to separate them out from stuff that, you know, didn't really need to be verified or was, you know, just a spin on something. And then that was hard. I mean, it wasn't easy, but it was really interesting to see how sincerely and earnestly they tackled that problem.
Okay, so I'm going to play a couple pieces of sound here. First, we have Mr. Cohen, and he is providing a little guidance for the Ron Johnson ad team.
He says Kenosha set on fire. If we Googled right now, was Kenosha set on fire? What would we find? Well, I guess Peter's doing it right now. He can tell us. What I'm getting at is there a fact here, but there's something missing in the fact? Kenosha may have been set on fire, but, like, what is missing here? Context.
Who set it on fire?
Who set it on fire? Why it was set on fire in the context?
Did they eventually get to a full understanding of the context? And for listeners, we're talking September 2020 protests in Kenosha after in the aftermath of unrest from a shooting of Jacob Blake, a black man who was shot in the back 7 times by a white police officer answering a domestic dispute call. How far did they get in combing that out, Joe Lepore?
They got pretty far. I mean, we didn't have as much time as you'd want if you were doing this for real. But they came to understand that Johnson's ad, in terms of the spoken words, was really just a list of phrases invoking chaos and especially violence, and that a lot of it was a reference to the supposed violence of the Black Lives Matter movement, or labeling that movement as responsible for chaos and political disruption in American life today. So, you know, they were able to, you know, to figure out what he was signaling by saying that. But there were, in fact, fires in Kenosha, right? So it kind of asks a interesting question about evidence. What, and was that true enough? That's the question that we were asked, you know, charged by Zittrain's thought experiment them to come to an answer for.
We're speaking with Harvard's Jill Lepore, who in this current season of The Last Archive brings Jonathan Zittrain's thought experiment to Cambridge Ringgen Latin High School. So here's now a little bit of sound from the podcast. This is the team assigned for fact-checking Democrat Mandela Barnes from Wisconsin, starting with a student that you identify as Ari.
I mean, he said protect the rights of the LGBTQ community. Like, even though that's super broad, I feel like it's at least a stance, kind of.
But it's still so vague.
I feel like protecting workers is something that either one of them could say, like the Democrat and the Republican could both
say. Yeah, what does it mean to protect workers?
Exactly, right.
I also thought it was odd how he said we were the first to protect the rights of the LGBTQ community. But I'm like, what does that mean?
So that was really striking, Jill. To me as well, that the Ron Johnson team was dealing with a series, as you said, of claims that sort of invoke chaos. The Mandela Barnes ad was squishy, and they had to deal with how do you get your hands around squishy, which strikes me as really hard, whether you're a high school student or, you know, a 55-year-old reading or viewing political ads.
Yeah, although I think teenagers have a really good detector for deception and dissembling, right? Like, they're just very on it about who's being phony. So if anything, they're better than a 55-year-old that's sort of being a little skeptical. Like, okay, so why the Mandela Barnes ad was sort of hilarious in that he has running shoes on and he's running the whole ad. Like, he's talking, you're a voiceover, he's just running everywhere. And they're like, where is he running to? Like, it seems somehow directionless to them. So they had really interesting conversation about whether the ad was effective. And I think that in and of itself was great pedagogy, right? Like, they learned so much about what, you know, we would teach as media literacy, how to look at these ads and what to think about and what to ask about them. It is absolutely the case, though, nailing these guys down on any statements was really difficult because you discover that politicians say very little of significance in political ads.
So The Last Archive asks, how do we know what we know and how can we be sure? Did these high school students, these Cambridge high school students, teach you anything new about that in your experience with them?
Yeah, they really did, because I was delighted to see that they are not swept away by partisanship. They are not as polarized as probably the rest of their families. We took this experiment, kind of scaled it up and used two schools in New Hampshire and Vermont in a later episode, and had the same experience there. The kids were really kind of open-hearted, really reluctant to to decide that any ad should be taken down. Very determined to say, you know, a lot of kids really disagreed with Ron Johnson in that classroom, but they all said, I learned so much about him from this ad. This seems so important to our political discourse. That kind of generosity of spirit and kind of political open-mindedness was, I felt like it was a gift to me to have this chance to spend time with these kids.
Fantastic. All right, that's Jill Lepore, podcaster, host of The Last Archive, and author of These Truths, A History of the United States, also staff writer for The New Yorker and Harvard University professor. Jill, it is always great to speak with you. Thanks for joining us and for taking us back to high school in Cambridge this time around.
Thanks so much.
Yeah. You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and what you're hearing right now is something a little different, and I love it. I can't lie. That's right. We've got a live DJ here in Studio 2 with me for a new segment that we're calling Sample This. DJ Real P is the founder of Boston Silk R&B Party and a Boston Music Award winner. DJ Real P, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. This is going to be so much fun.
I can't wait.
All right, so we're going to have a lot of fun over a long time talking to you about local artists, new music, but today we're going to do something a little different. Because this segment is called Sample This, we're going to learn what sampling is, because I know you know, and I know this much, just a little, but we want everyone to know.
Well, you'll be a sampling expert after this.
Excellent. All right, so start with, what is it? How did it start?
Well, a sample is really taking a track and taking some elements out of a song. So like you're hearing right now, you're listening to Bob James, Take Me to the Mardi Gras. And a producer or a DJ will take elements from a song, whether it be the drums, for example, this.
Okay.
And incorporate that into a new song. So there's opportunities to take maybe even strings, vocals, different parts of any song. Sampling really started way back in like the 40s.
Did it?
Yes.
So my son is really into jazz. He's a jazz musician.
Yep.
And he talks in jazz all the time about quoting.
Mm-hmm.
That you'll hear one musician quote something that was signature in jazz from another musician. Is it the same kind of thing?
Similar.
Okay.
In that case, quoting is they play a similar style to that musician and kind of add their own kind of nuanced ways. Sampling is really taking
this is a lift.
An element. Yeah, it is a lift. So there was some controversy up the front end when sampling started. Is the stealing? But we think it's really creative integrity, creative outlet. Folks take certain parts and add their own style to it.
Yeah.
So it really started in the 40s. A lot of folks in the 40s in Europe were creating devices that can now loop songs. So that's how it originally started. But it really got taken up a notch in New York during the birth of hip-hop during the 70s. So a lot of DJs like Kool Herc, Grand Wizard Theodore, and Grandmaster Flash used to do loops like this.
Yeah, give us another example.
Mm-hmm. They used to take breakbeats from disco songs in a party.
Mm-hmm.
So like, for example...
Wait, what's a breakbeat?
So a breakbeat is a part in a song that the drums only live.
Got it.
So everything else drops out except the drums.
Okay.
So Bob James, Take Me to the Mardi Gras, this is a breakbeat. So just imagine you're in the 70s in a party.
You're doing this.
And the DJ is looping this back and forth, and the dance floor is open. Everyone's jamming, having a good time. All the dancers, the B-boys, step out in the middle and do their dances. So that's really what a breakbeat is. And that was the kind of the first iteration of sampling when it comes to hip-hop. That got taken up a notch a few years later with Marley Marl of the Juice Crew in Queens.
Can you give us an example of that?
Yeah.
Is that doable?
So what you're hearing is Bob James Take Me to the Mardi Gras, which you're about to hear, is Funky Drummer by James Brown. Funky Drummer is probably the most sampled song in history.
I love it.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's such a fine foundational... record where it's been sampled over 3,000 times. That
Wait,
one
in 3,000 different pieces of music.
3,000 pieces of music.
Wow.
Yep.
Wow.
So this is the breakbeat on James Brown's Funky Drummer. Here's the breakbeat.
There it is. Oh yeah, that sounds so familiar now when you play it like that.
Yeah, so let me loop it for you and give you a little example.
Okay.
Let's imagine, it's going this fast, 104, that's beats per minute, by the way.
Yep.
And if I slow it down, it's a whole
another
song.
Now we got a whole different groove, that's
whole
right.
Whole different groove.
How slow is this now?
This is about 79 beats per minute.
All right.
So, someone like Marley Marl, who took It's a Demo, which is a classic record from, I believe, 79.
All right.
Featuring DJ Polo and Kool G Rap. He took this same breakbeat and implemented in this.
There it is.
Here, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
All right.
So Marley Marl is credited as being the person who discovered, quote unquote, discovered sampling.
All right.
Obviously, people were sampling a little before him.
but he's kind of the pioneer.
And this was 79?
This was 79 or 80.
Okay, so yep. Two questions for you coming off that, based on the things I've just learned from you.
Yep.
One is, I think I'm hearing from you that sampling actually is also a product of the technology that makes it possible.
Absolutely.
So this loop in the 1940s, it was the first time we could physically do that.
Yep.
And so somebody said, well, then I want to do that.
I want to do that, and I want to take it up a notch.
Okay, and then how did the technology change in the 70s and 80s to make this level of sampling possible?
Yep. So the MPC, which was made by a company called Akai, which still makes musical products.
It's a piece of equipment.
It's a piece of equipment. It's a drum pad. It had 16 little pads on it.
Yep.
That you're able to upload different parts of a song and press different pads, and it'll activate that part
like
of the song.
Like a little trigger, almost.
Exactly.
Okay. Okay.
All right. So yep. Just imagine Marley Marl, even I'll take it to South Bronx with the Boogie Down Productions. They took certain parts of this song.
Yo, what's up, Blastmaster KRS-One? This jam is
this sample funky drummer too.
Yeah.
You'll hear it. So they took the MPC and maybe this that you're hearing was a pad.
Okay.
The drum break was a pad.
Yep.
And maybe different other parts. Maybe some vocals were a pad as well. You hear funky drummer in there?
Yeah, I do. That's fantastic.
Beautiful, right?
Yes.
Music lives forever that way.
Well, so here's what's the, and this is the second piece that I want to ask you, and this is the perfect chance to ask it. You talked about, okay, so there's controversy at the beginning with sampling.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, I just want to reset for everybody. We're speaking with DJ Real P. This is the first of a series that we'll be doing called Sample This. And today we're learning what sampling is.
Yeah.
Because it's the foundation of everything we're going to talk about in the future. So sampling was controversial, right?
Yep.
In the old world of poetry, you go back to Byron and, you know, Shakespeare, and it would have been called plagiarism.
Plagiarism.
And it could have gotten you into a duel and gotten you killed,
yep.
Right? But somehow
like
we recognize that this is doing honor and springboarding off of someone else's genius to create your own. How do we do that? How do we make that shift? How does that happen?
Well, the shift has happened. Because I mean, a lot of court decisions helped.
So
push that forward.
The courts actually helped.
Yes.
Okay.
So that the courts helped because a lot of old artists felt like these newer artists were stealing their work, obviously, and they weren't getting compensated and getting credit for it.
Yeah.
So the courts formalized this process, and now a lot of older artists, like for example Clyde Stubblefield, who was the drummer on Funky Drummer.
Okay.
Now his estate gets paid every time Funky Drummer is sampled.
Got it.
And James Brown and whoever else is on that song. So
yep.
They get writing credits on these newer sampled songs.
Which keeps you, what's the word
keeps
I'm looking
for? Keeps you relevant.
For? Immortal.
Yes, keeps you immortal.
Yeah.
I have a 13-year-old and he just discovered Bill Withers because of a sampled song from 2020.
Fantastic. I don't suppose you have that song by any chance.
I don't. I lied. I will find it right now.
Awesome. So this is your 13-year-old found.
My 13-year-old.
All right.
Found Grandma's Hands by Bill Withers.
If you had told me that in this conversation we were going to wind up at Bill Withers, it's fantastic.
Grandma's hands clapped in church on Sunday morning.
It's fantastic. Grandma's
so let me replay the sample for you just
yeah.
So you can see it.
Yeah.
So listen.
Oh my God, I love it. And yet if you had just played this for me, I would have never said to you, that's Bill Withers.
Yep.
Right?
Never know.
I wouldn't have, well, and honestly, I wouldn't have known to listen that way.
Exactly.
Have you learned to listen differently because of
Absolutely.
Your art?
Absolutely. I think I have a keen ear for sampled songs. There's a sound that is attached to sampled songs.
Yeah.
And there are newer producers that now take unsampled songs and add that effect. So it sounds sampled.
Right.
It's a nostalgic feeling.
How do you listen for that? How do you? Can you even describe it?
I'm not sure if I can.
Is it like a patina on the sound or a...
There's a crackling that's there.
Okay.
That kind of signifies kind of a turntable use.
Okay.
It has less of a digital effect. It has an analog feel.
Got it.
It's a feeling. I can't really explain it.
Yeah.
But it is definitely a feeling.
So we're talking with DJ Real P. This is the first of our Sample This segments here on Radio Boston. And if you are having half as much fun as I am right now, you're welcome. As we keep talking about this, we're learning about sampling. Bring it home for us now to Boston artists who have been sampled, Boston's contribution to the art of sampling, to your work, anywhere you want to go with that.
Yeah, I mean, Boston is a musical hub, as you know. We have some legends that came out of our city. Aerosmith, Donald Summer, New Edition. So those folks have been sampled numerous times. Aerosmith has a big hand in kind of the transformation of hip-hop, I should say, especially with their song with Run DMC.
With Walk This Way.
Walk This Way. So I'll play the Run DMC and Aerosmith version. And there is two versions. So this version is a lot faster.
I was just thinking, wow, that's faster than I remember.
Yep.
Okay.
And you probably remember the original Aerosmith version.
Sure do. Yeah. Which, okay. So in all honesty, now feels a little empty, right? Yep. When you hear this version of it, this feels analog.
Empty, yes.
Right? And empty.
Mm-hmm.
And then you hear the Run DMC version, and there's a texture to it.
Exactly.
Right, that you don't hear. No disrespect to Aerosmith, but there's a texture to it with the Run DMC version.
That's correct. So, Run DMC, Walk This Way was sampled a number of times.
Was it?
Yes.
See, I only knew about the Run DMC.
That. So, this is De La Soul called Keeping the Faith.
Okay.
Hear that Aerosmith drum?
Oh, it's in the drums. Yeah. I do. Hey, now you're cracking me up. Yeah. Yeah, it's right there. It's clear you got to learn to hear it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's fantastic. So, was it a business decision for them, or were they just forward thinkers to say, I want to be a part of this?
I think they were forward thinkers, like all Bostonians, right? but I think their kind of friendship with Run DMC forced them to think that way.
Yeah.
Run DMC, which was a part of Def Jam at the time, Beastie Boys, Rick Rubin, they were chronic samplers.
Yeah.
So I think Aerosmith and Run DMC's relationship helped push sampling to the forefront and helped it to be a little bit more acceptable.
Yeah, that makes sense. What else from Boston? You mentioned Donna Summer.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I have a great Donna Summer sample here. This is called My Baby Understands by Donna Summer.
Okay. While we're hearing this, we're doing sampling. This is our first segment with DJ Real P here in Studio 2. Never my baby loves me. Oh, she's so good.
Isn't she amazing?
Never my baby needs me, and he often does. Well, I'm attracted by desire. Ooh,
he's a I'll skip a little forward for her.
Okay. And I don't even think this was a song I knew well.
Yeah.
From Donna Summer. Yeah. Okay.
You hear that?
Yep. So now you've pulled a piece out, right?
Yes.
Yep.
So this is a vocal piece from Donna Summer.
Okay.
And we're going to get into She Got Her Own by Neo, which is an R&B song.
Yep.
And you'll hear the, oh, you hear that.
All right. Oh, no way.
Wow.
Right? Right.
Isn't it beautiful?
Yes.
So they pitched her up a little bit.
Uh-huh. But that's her. That's not someone else singing it. That's
not someone else singing it. That's her pitched up a couple keys, probably about three or four keys.
Using a computer.
Using a computer. And it kind of chipmunks her voice a little bit. But it has that effect. It's good. It still feels good.
Amazing. Amazing.
So what you talked about was someone could potentially re-sing it.
Yep.
And that's called an interpolation.
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 Okay. But if you use the actual original core music, which you can grab again now because of the way technology works then that's sampling.
That is sampling.
And do you have a preference? Or is it just it depends on the music?
I think it depends on the music and it depends on the producer. You know, some producers put it directly in your face and you can tell what the sample is immediately.
Yeah.
Or you can tell it's sampled.
Yeah.
Others do a good job at making, probably taking 2 seconds from a song, chopping it up, layering it, EQing it, so you can never tell what song this came from.
What's EQing?
EQing means you can manipulate either the highs or lows or mids of a song. Uh-huh. So the lows is kind of like the bottom, the bass.
The bone.
Yeah, the bones.
Yep.
The mid is really like the meat that holds everything
like
together.
Like the frequency?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. And then there's highs. Highs, which are the high level kind of tweeters that your ear pierces up when you hear it.
Yep. And you can moderate all that.
You can moderate all that.
So you can create these different effects.
Yep. So you can take a drum loop, you can take a vocal loop,
yep.
and you can EQ it to your preference.
Yep.
And change its feeling, change its texture.
Fantastic. So who's your favorite producer when it comes to sampling? Or one of them? Mm. Somebody you really admire?
I mean, I know he's in the news for not great things, but Kanye's probably
my... We can separate the art.
Yes.
And listen, we'll name it right here. We understand there will be people who will be uncomfortable for the fact that we're playing his music right now.
Yep.
But in this space of sampling, let's hear the art.
All right. Well, this is Curtis Mayfield, Move On Up.
Okay.
You hear the horns?
I do.
Big
I
band.
Love the horns,
beautiful.
Yes, that's right up my alley. Hush now, child. Da-da-da-da-da. And don't cry. Isn't that?
So remember those horns.
Okay.
Let's play the Kanye version. It's called Touch the Sky.
I gotta testify. Come up in the spot looking extra fly. For the day I die.
There it is. You can hear those horns. Gotta testify. And of course, if you had said to me, you know what I really love about a Kanye West song is the horns, I probably would have been like, I'm sorry, right? But they're there. They're really there. Yeah. And they sound fantastic.
So Kanye has made himself notoriously famous, amongst other things, but in terms of sampling, he has mastered the art of pitching samples up and down.
Got it.
So he speeds samples up. But then he fits it into a pocket, which is like a groove.
A groove, right.
He fits into a pocket that fits perfectly.
All right.
And you can never notice that it was a sample or it was manipulated.
All right. So take us out now on one more brilliant sample.
Ooh, okay. One more brilliant one.
Yep.
I have plenty of brilliant ones here. Let's do this one. This is Enya. The song is called Boadicea.
Okay.
She is an Irish...
Yep.
Folk artist. Very dramatic up the front end.
Okay. Very haunting.
Very haunting.
Yeah.
Has a feeling to it.
It does.
Into a classic.
Okay. Listen to that.
You hear it?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I do.
And this is Ready or Not by the Fugees.
Yeah.
Ready or not, here I
come. Oh, my God. Again, if you had told me, right? I would have never gotten it. I get it now. I hear it.
Yep.
Right? But if you had told me that the Fugees were doing a song rooted in Enya, it's incredible.
It is incredible.
It's incredible.
So it just shows that, you know, music is connected no matter the genre, no matter the era, no matter the place. There is a connectivity through music.
Well, we are going to go on a wonderful journey with you in the future. This is just the beginning with DJ Real P, who's the founder of Boston's Silk R&B Party and a Boston Music Award winner. Not hard to imagine why. DJ Real P, this is a great introduction to sampling. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Really appreciate
it. Appreciate it.
And that's our show for today. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow. We'll have some more Radio Boston. Gun blast, think fast, I think I'm hit. My girl pinched my hips to see if I still exist. I think not, I'll send a letter.